Hello, welcome to You've Got Kids, and today we are speaking to Patricia Casey, who is a Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry in UCD, and who is now also the Consultant Psychiatrist up in the Mater Hospital. And today we're going to be talking about prenatal and postnatal depression, and Patricia is going to give us her input on the subject.
Hello Anya, and thank you for inviting me along. I'm delighted to be here.
It's lovely to have you, and thanks for inviting us to your home to do this. We're grateful to be here. I suppose the reason why we wanted to do this podcast is because I myself have suffered with pre and postnatal depression in the past, and I think it's a subject that's not really spoken about. And then I think there's a lot of women who suffer in silence. Would you agree?
I think you're right. I mean, thankfully it's changing, and more women are going to their, it's usually the GP they would go to initially. So more and more are doing that. But a lot of women don't actually recognize that they've got depression. And so, as you say, they suffer in silence, and particularly for pregnant women, that can actually be damaging, not just to themselves, but to the baby as well. And a lot of people don't appreciate that there are two people who are going to be affected when a woman has depression during pregnancy. We know that, for example, pregnant women who are depressed have lower birth weight babies. There's also the risk of premature delivery. And then after birth, the babies can often be quite irritable and cry a lot. So getting treatment for depression in the prenatal phase is very important. How do you know you have it? The symptoms are really the same as the symptoms of depression that occurs at any other time of life, both within pregnancy and outside of pregnancy, like low mood, difficulty sleeping, poor concentration, loss of appetite and weight loss, general disinterest in life, a lack of sort of a flatness, a feeling of flatness. And if there are other children in the family, the woman may have difficulty relating to those children. So the symptoms are not unusual symptoms. They don't differ from the symptoms that occur at any other time. Some that may be unique would be feelings around the pregnancy. For example, if the pregnancy was a much desired pregnancy, when the woman becomes depressed, she won't get the same joy at being pregnant that she would have anticipated getting. If it was an unplanned pregnancy, an unexpected pregnancy, the woman may be more distressed than usual about that, than she would have anticipated about that. So those are the symptoms that are pregnancy related. There will often be also an increasing worry about the baby, that the baby isn't going to be healthy, that the baby is going to be in some way not well, not quote normal, that the baby will have some kind of deficit when the baby is born, that are not based on any real, not based on any reality. For example, the scans would all have been normal and the baby would be growing normally, but the woman may still worry that there's going to be something the matter when the baby is born. So getting treatment is very important. Some background issues may be causing problems, like the partner or husband may not be as supportive as she would like, and that will add to her distress as well. Sometimes if she's working, she may experience problems at work, and her workmates may not be as supportive as she would have envisaged. So there are all of those things going on in the background. But the main thing is that this comes out of the blue and has these symptoms of, you know, we've talked about loss of weight, loss of appetite, sadness, tearfulness. And that does need treatment if it's affecting the woman's day-to-day functioning. It may require antidepressants. It doesn't always require antidepressants, but may do.
Yeah, it's interesting when I hear you saying that it can be something that the woman isn't even aware of, because I on my first girl, I had a lot going on. We'd bought our house in Clane at the time, and I had just lost my job, and my mother was diagnosed with cancer, and I also had a relative in my care at the time. And I don't think I ever had the time to absorb what was actually happening within me while I was expecting my fourth child. Because I think women in general just have this expectation that when you're pregnant, it's going to be sheer joy, especially if the baby's planned. Like, if you've planned this pregnancy and you think it's just going to be, you think you make plans and you think they're going to go the way you plan them. And then life happens. And that is a part of life.
Yes.
And when that happens, it kind of knocks you for six, but a lot of the time you don't realise. So at the time I would have been doing hospital runs with my mother who had cancer, and I would have been obviously doing school runs with the relative that was in my care at the time. And then we were both young as well. We just bought this house. My husband was still in college. He was still studying. And we look, with the help of God, we were blessed that we were able to manage the mortgage payments and that, you know. And it wasn't until I was pregnant on my second daughter that my mother begged me, could she come to an appointment with me? And it was herself. It took my mother almost to reveal to the midwives and the doctors that I wasn't doing well. And I can remember sitting in the car with my ma crying. My ma was crying, and my mother is not a crier. Like, and she, I remember she crying and said, "Annie, what can I do? What can I do?" And when I eventually got the help and the support that I needed, I realised that it stemmed from the very first pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And I'd never dealt with it. And, you know, my husband was very supportive, but in ways, I would say he probably didn't understand a lot of what was going on for me at the time.
What you're saying is absolutely right. Often the person themselves doesn't identify that they're not coping well, or that there's something amiss, or that they've changed. It takes others to notice it. And often it will be somebody who perhaps isn't seeing the person every day, but maybe every week or every 2 weeks, and notices that they're not the same. If you live with somebody, it's very difficult to notice subtle changes, the subtle changes that happen every day with depression as the depression gets worse. It will often take a stranger, a friend, or in your case, your mother. And it's lucky that it did, and that she insisted on coming with you, because there are many people who wouldn't be in that position, who wouldn't have somebody to come with them, or who wouldn't have the cop on to say, look, you're not actually yourself, can I go with you to an appointment to discuss it on your behalf with the doctors? And indeed, it's good that she did that. And then sometimes, of course, doctors can be odd about things like that as well, and not want another person,
yeah,
come in and see them. They'd probably be okay with a spouse, but somebody's mother might be not acceptable. So it's good that that actually came together for you, and all the pieces fell into place, and you got the help that you needed.
Yeah, I was lucky in the sense that, you know, I wasn't expecting my mother when I went into the hospital to tell them. I didn't know that's why she wanted. And it was when they were questioning me and saying, and how are you doing in yourself and all? And it was my mum said, she's not doing great. And that was like, that kind of set the ball in motion, where I was, you know, accepting that I'm feeling down in myself. But also there's another aspect to it, I think, as well, Patricia, that nobody ever talks about. It is, a lot of the time, it is normal to have an awful lot of anxieties and worries around pregnancy. For example, you know, my mother told me when she was, you know, down on herself a few years ago, I'm not talking about the actual clinical depression, I'm talking about just, you know, general depression, like, about like regarding life. And she said she went down to the doctor, and I can't remember whether she got to the appointment or whether she met the woman on the way back to the appointment. This woman met her and said to her, did your mother never tell you that it's normal for women about 4 or 5 times in our lives we're going to get down on ourselves? And that's okay. It's almost, you need to have to accept that it's okay to be depressed. Yes. Do you know what I'm saying? For it to happen, it was like this element of shame around. I didn't want anybody knowing that I wasn't coping because I felt embarrassed about it as well, you know.
Low mood is part of life at certain times in people's life when, you know, things happen that causes their mood to dip. And I think we need to be very careful that we distinguish that normal, appropriate unhappiness. There are some things that happen in life where if you weren't unhappy and worried about them, it would be abnormal. Yeah. So that we clearly need to distinguish between those episodes and what we call clinical depression, where, you know, somebody is actually not functioning properly because of their feelings and their emotions. And there's a danger nowadays that people will get put on treatments or referred indeed for therapy when what they're experiencing is a perfectly legitimate phase in their life for feeling down and low in mood and just a bit under the weather. Sick children, bereavements, major financial worries, marital problems, all of those things can cause people to feel down and just a bit under the weather. And it would be very wrong to start prescribing drugs or therapy for those kinds of things, because most people can get through those periods without any professional intervention if they've got somebody to talk to, like your best friend or your neighbour or your mother or, you know, your spouse or whoever. And that is important, to get the support and advice of others rather than resorting to medication or to professional therapy. So I think we need to have a balance. And that's why when you go to the doctor feeling low in mood, they will be able to make that distinction. They don't always, unfortunately. But if, for example, in your low mood, you're worst in the morning, if you're waking early in the morning and not able to get back to sleep, if you're having excessive worries about things that really would never have worried you before, then that's an indicator that you've got what we call clinical depression and need professional intervention rather than just common sense and a shoulder to cry on and talking with your nearest and dearest.
Yeah, because like you were saying there, for the times that I was pregnant, a lot of the time when I was suffering, if you want to say, in my own suffering, I couldn't sleep. I wasn't sleeping great. And I spent a lot of the time in my head convincing myself that something, I had this feeling of dread around me constantly. Something terrible is going to happen because I deserve it. Mm-hmm. And then I had this worry that I wasn't going to be the mother that, I had this thing that I wasn't going to be a good mother, you know. And then even when I had my other children and I suffered again in pregnancy, and I found pregnancy in general was a trigger for me.
Yes.
That when I was attending St. Mary's and I spoke to the psychologist and that and the psychiatrist, I was saying to them, you know, one of my worries is actual pregnancy. And the thing is, I suppose if you look at it in a way that, you know, an awful lot of people would, I can't think of how I'm trying to say this now. I need to word this carefully because I don't want anyone thinking that that's an excuse to say, you know, my biggest worry, say, for instance, during the referendum was that there was women like me who would be very, very vulnerable.
Yes.
And could easily make a decision that they would later on regret.
Yes. Oh, indeed, that's a very valid worry, that women who are depressed may well, and I know it certainly in the UK when women are depressed in pregnancy, they're often offered a termination of pregnancy in the belief that it's the pregnancy itself that's causing the depression, and if you end the pregnancy, all will be well. Yeah. And you're right, people at that time would be very vulnerable, and it's to be hoped that that will not happen in this country. I think something like that will happen, probably as abortion becomes more acceptable, if we get to that stage, and hopefully we don't. But women are very vulnerable when they are pregnant and feeling low in mood. And instead of abortion, what they should be offered is proper treatment, either pharmacological treatment or psychological treatment, or ideally a combination of both.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. And that's why I was saying I have to be careful how I word that, because I was afraid of how it might, you know, sound to somebody else listening, because I do think we have to mind ourselves and mind women in general, especially during pregnancy. For me, that was one of the biggest issues during the referendum. I knew there was going to be women like me who'll need actual support and actual help, as opposed to being told, you know, if you do this, yes, you're going to be all right. Because I remember when I was pregnant, at one stage I was suicidal, mm-hmm. and I drove to Wicklow at all hours of the night. And I'm being very honest here because I think it's an important story to tell. I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I took my keys, and I had convinced myself that I wasn't going to be that my husband and my children that I already had, that they would be 100% better off without me in their lives. And I know in my head I didn't want to do anything stupid, like when I look back on it. But at the same time, what was I doing at 5 o'clock in the morning, driving to the Wicklow Mountains, planning on driving off a cliff somewhere? And I sat in my car, and I had a spiritual revelation where I felt God just stepped into the picture at the right time for me. Mm-hmm. I just remember a verse of the Bible came to me, and it was like, "Be still and know that I am God." And that was just my personal experience.
Yes.
And I rang my husband, and I said, "I'm up in Wicklow," and, you know, I cried on the phone, and I said, "I can't believe I'm here again in this space," in this sense of, you know, this frame of mind. And like that again, it was time to get the help again, yes, that was needed.
When people become suicidal, that's exactly how they feel. You've given, yeah, a very clear description of it, that people feel that the other people would be better off without them, when clearly, you know, losing a child or a sibling or any family member or any loved one to suicide is terrible, and nobody is better off. It's a lose-lose situation. The person loses their life, the family are devastated, and communities can actually be adversely affected by, yeah, by suicide as well, because neighbours and friends feel guilty, you know, at not having spotted that the person was so depressed. So what your personal experience is what a lot of suicidal people experience, and that's why why people need help. Now, thankfully, in this country, there has been a development in the last number of years where nurses who are highly trained in assessing suicide risk see every single person who presents to the emergency departments thinking of suicide or with having acted upon their urges and maybe taken an overdose or harmed themselves. And everybody is seen and assessed and then discussed by a consultant psychiatrist. I, in the Mater Hospital, I'm the person involved in that service. But round the country, the upshot of this has been positive in that the suicide rate is now dropping. It's begun to drop in the last 2 to 3 years, and it's almost certainly because of the fact that these people who, like you, are suicidal and actually look for help through the emergency department are properly assessed, and then the assessment within 24 hours is conveyed to the GP so that the GP can act upon the advice. It may be to send the person to an outpatient clinic, it may be to immediately commence antidepressants, it may be to refer it may be an urgent referral to the psychiatric service, it may be a referral for psychological intervention, but whatever, it's conveyed immediately to the GP within 24 hours. And so the desire to kill oneself can then be contained and treatment offered.
Yeah, because I there's another element around when you suffer with depression, it's almost like an element of guilt as well, because I have a good life, I have a good husband, I have wonderful children, I have, you know, a wonderful mother and father and brothers and sisters and all that. But I don't get me wrong, I've suffered in the past. I know loss, I know grief, I know hurt. And but at the same time, when this was happening to me, there was an element of guilt as well. Like, you know, you don't have a right to be like this.
Well, guilt is one of the symptoms of depression. It's a red flag symptom. If people have abnormal guilt, It's a red flag that they might act on that guilt and feel because of the guilt and because they're not good enough that people would be better off without them. And that's a red flag symptom for any psychiatrist. And if a patient says that to me, I really would often want to admit them to hospital for their own safety until they can get through that phase. And with treatment, people can come through that phase of guilt, you know, pretty quickly, you know, a week to 10 days once they start antidepressants, they can come through that phase and then get a different perspective, a more positive perspective. And really, depression is about perspective and how you view things, how you view the world, how you view yourself in the world, how you view your future. Mm. And cognitive therapy can change that, but it takes longer. If you need to change it quickly, antidepressants will do it more quickly.
We'll do it quickly for them. Thankfully, I never needed to go on antidepressants at the time. Like if it was to happen ever again, I wouldn't be so hesitant to say no, you know, that kind of way. But in both the psychiatrist that I had at the time and myself didn't feel that there was a need, because I was kind of, I'm naturally that type of person that when I'm in an okay frame of mind, I can kind of say to myself, okay, I know what's happening. So one thing I would say to anybody who is kind of suffering with depression or, you know, expecting a baby, and as you said, you have to know the difference between feeling normal lows, which are also important, I think, to talk about as well, you know, the normal lows that women have when they're pregnant or when they do have a baby. For instance, I had a cesarean section after 2 days of labour on my fourth little girl, and looking back now, I can remember when I was taken to the ICU to see her because she had to spend some time up there, and I remember looking at her and I just remember thinking, I almost didn't believe she was mine. Mm-hmm. Because I hadn't held her straight away, I didn't have the mm-hmm. natural birth, and I remember whatever happened, it affected me in my mind for a while, you know, and I was afraid, terrified of the bond and everything, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, holding the baby or even touching the baby, if the baby can't be held initially, but actually touching the baby, even holding the hand, can actually make a difference informing the initial bond with the baby.
Yeah.
You raise an important issue, because if a woman is pregnant and depressed and doesn't take treatment, and then delivers the baby, her depression will still be there, and that's actually going to affect the bond. That can actually interfere with the bond. So that's again why treatment is so important, because not only will the woman be adversely affected, but her relationship with the baby will be affected as well. Yeah. From the very early stages. So you're going to get a more tearful baby, and later on, possibly, if they haven't formed a bond, a more clingy baby. So it's very important to get treatment. And one of the questions that does arise is, will I take antidepressants during pregnancy, if you're depressed during pregnancy, or indeed breastfeeding? And while there is absolutely no drug that's safe in pregnancy, even an aspirin isn't safe in pregnancy, and all of the guidelines for every single drug say it should be discussed with your doctor. But with antidepressants, as I say, none is licensed for use in pregnancy, but some are much safer than others and have a very good track record. And in particular, a drug called sertraline, which is marketed as Lustral, is safe in pregnancy. I say safe insofar as any drug is safe in pregnancy.
Yes, I understand.
And also is safe in breastfeeding women. So I think, and there's Prozac is also relatively safe in pregnancy. There are some about which there's very little information, and there's one paroxetine, also called Seroxat, that shouldn't be used in pregnancy because it can cause problems. But a lot of the others are relatively safe, insofar as, you know, with the caveat that I've given. So I think if there's anybody listening to this podcast who is pregnant and who is on an antidepressant, or who is thinking of taking an antidepressant or being advised to take an antidepressant, what you have to do, you have to do two things. You have to talk about it with your doctor, and there's a list of definitely unsafe antidepressants and ones that are deemed to be
Better. Yeah,
less worrisome. And the second thing you have to do is you have to balance the impact of the depression on you and on your unborn baby against the dangers the antidepressant will pose.
Of course.
So you have to make that risk-benefit balance. You've got to do that, and your doctor will do it with you. And if you're seeing a psychiatrist, they'll help you to do it as well. Because a depressed pregnant woman isn't good for anybody, not good for the baby. As I say, it can be low birth weight. They can also lead to be associated with premature deliveries and then difficulties forming the relationship after.
And also we want women to be healthy in themselves. Like it's a horrible thing to be going around feeling miserable
of course.
And there is support there, like if you're willing to reach out, you know. And a lot of the time it's important for husbands or partners or sisters or brothers to kind of watch whoever's pregnant around you as well, because sometimes you might not necessarily be depressed in your childhood or in your teens or in adulthood, but sometimes when you're pregnant, you can become depressed.
Yes. And it's important also to say that if you have become depressed during pregnancy or after pregnancy, you will have a risk of becoming depressed later on. So the fact that it's pregnancy related doesn't reduce your risk further later on. You will still be at risk of becoming depressed outside of pregnancy. So, the patient needs to be aware of that. The woman herself needs to be aware of that. That if at a later stage when she's not pregnant, she's feeling low, she mustn't say, oh, well, I had postnatal depression. This can't be depression. It may be, and it may well be if you've been depressed before, and she needs to take the usual steps to get professional help and advice about it.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good point that you make, because I myself suffered depression while I wasn't pregnant, whether it be pre or postnatal. And I think there's many people who are like that. But I think the fact that we're even here having this conversation, it's gonna, people will be listening, and hopefully they'll, get the courage to talk or to tell somebody how they're feeling. Or, as I said, my sister is expecting her baby next month. And I've been kind of watching her throughout pregnancy, because I know I've been there. And it's important just to, be mindful of the people in our lives, isn't it? Like, and to be mindful of ourselves.
Yes.
To, because now I know, I'll never say I'm never going to get depressed again, because I know I can.
Yes.
I'm a human being, and I know I can, I'm more likely to get down than others are. Mm. And, I know there's a lot of people who also suffer what you say is the clinical depression and probably need the medical intervention. But I think it's the awareness. If you're aware of it, you can deal with it.
I was just going to make that point. If you've had depression and you've coped with it and got through it with treatment, by depression, I mean clinical depression, and you also know that in the future, if you get depressed, it can be treated. And people should know that if you have recurrent episodes of depression, that you can take antidepressants long term to give prophylaxis, in the same way that if you had, hypertension, you might need antihypertensives long term to keep it under control. Or if you had thyroid disease, you might need long term medication. So you can also have long term antidepressants quite safely to control recurrent depressive disorder. And in so doing, if you do suffer with this, it means you will be there for your family to, bring them up. You won't be having, these recurrent episodes interfering with your life. You will actually be a well person, able to cope and get on with things.
To get on with life. And is it fair to say then also that somebody could just have one episode?
Yes, you may well only have one episode, but if you've had a second episode, with each episode, your risk of recurrence increases.
It increases.
Increases.
That's good to know, because I didn't even know that should be something that could be considered.
Yes.
That
if at a future date you feel low in mood, below par, not coping very well, it may well be that your depression is recurring, and you can get treated, and you can deal with it, get it dealt with professionally, overcome it, and as I say, be there for your family, and not feel stigmatized. I say to people that depression has some social causes, but this at the severe end of the spectrum, it's a biological condition, and the brain is an organ too. People forget that the brain is like one of the organs of the body, that it can go awry, and in severe depression, that is what's happened, and the brain biology changes, and that's what leads to the severe depression, what we call melancholic type depression or psychotic depression. And that they're the names we use for the very severe end of the depressive spectrum. At the psychotic end, people will maybe believe that they have illnesses that they don't actually have. They feel guilty about minor things for no reason, very minor things for no reason. They feel suicidal. They sometimes believe that people are talking about them because they're bad people. And that's the psychotic end. And they may believe that the baby is in some way, even though the baby has been born and is healthy, they may believe that the baby isn't healthy. At the extreme end, they may believe that the devil is in the baby and may sometimes try to harm the baby.
Yeah.
With what we call melancholic depression, people feel worst in the morning. They may be almost a different person at 6 o'clock in the evening. And that's what family members say, you know, My wife in the morning is really low, can't get out of bed. By 6 o'clock, she's up and about watching television and laughing. And they don't understand that that's actually part of the melancholic type pattern of depression.
That's good to get that out there as well. And because it is important to understand the differences between the, I don't know if you'd say levels of depression.
Yes.
Do you know?
It is. Because at the more mild end of the spectrum, the mild to moderate end, people may not need medication. They will need, if they don't have medication, they'll certainly need cognitive therapy. But as you move up the severity, and severity is defined by how badly it's affecting the person's day-to-day function and by the symptom pattern. And when you get up to the severe end, you definitely need medication. You know, people will, it's very unlikely that people will respond simply to talking therapy at that level of depression. They will need medication. And then that's where you come to deciding which antidepressants are safe for the woman, for her unborn baby, and then if she's breastfeeding afterwards, what's safe to take when the person's breastfeeding.
Well, that's great. Listen, Patricia, you've been very good to tell us. Is there any to come in to talk to us today about this issue, because it is a very important issue and it affects so many women. And I did a video previously about this, and the response that I got from it was plenty of women who were so grateful that I was honest about it, because they were sitting at home on their own experiencing the same thing, mm-hmm. and they couldn't talk about it, and yeah. they thought they were abnormal. But when they seen that I was being honest and open about my experience, it gave them a comfort.
Yes.
And a lot of these women went on and got the help that they needed. And
it is quite common. Postnatal depression affects about 10% of women. So it's not uncommon.
Yeah.
And in the prenatal period, some of the studies say the same, but others put the figure lower at about 2-5%.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a recognized condition. It's there. It's not rare. And people should absolutely seek help. Most GPs will be able to deal with it now. There are psychologists working in general practices where mm-hmm. women with medical cards can get, I think, up to 12 sessions of psychology therapy free from a psychologist. It's called the Psychology in Primary Care, PIPC. And if they ask the GP, they can get referred to that. And then at the more severe end, they can get referred on to psychiatrists who are well used to dealing with depression. But sitting at home in silence feeling miserable is not going to be of benefit to any woman and to the baby that she's carrying.
And it's also to just mention as well that most of the hospitals have a support midwife there who generally
they do nowadays. They do absolutely all of the maternity hospitals, to my knowledge now, certainly all the Dublin ones, and I think gradually around the country they have midwives who will know about postnatal and prenatal depression and will be able to direct the person to the appropriate agencies for treatment.
Yeah. And just to add on a positive note before we finish up, when I suffered with the prenatal on my second child, it was based, my whole fear of throughout the whole pregnancy, I had this immense fear that I wasn't going to love her the same as I loved my first child. You know, I was just, the whole time I was just terrified, and I spent a lot of the time again in guilt, like what we were speaking about. And but when I had her, I did, it was like the weight was lifted off my shoulder. Yes. And I did feel this immense love for my child.
Yes.
And you know, it does get better, and there's always a light at the end of the tunnel.
There is, most definitely. Is. And you're living proof of it.
I am. And I think that's the most important thing, is that there is always going to be the light at the end of the tunnel. Life in general comes in waves, and
yes,
you know, it's just about getting the right support. So thanks a million, Patricia. I really appreciate
it. It's a great pleasure. Thank
you. To me.
Thanks, Anya.
I keep going to say coming in today and talking to us, because we're not in the studio. We'll be right back.